On this day in 1955, a 14-year-old boy named Emmett Till was murdered by two white men who drowned him in the Tallahatchie River and then got away with it in a court of law. Emmett Till was black, as most people know, and the story is one that does not get easier to hear with the passage of time. Something else that doesn't change is that the way we tell this story is still rooted in race and geography. It's a phenomenon KU professor David Tell calls the ecology of memory. His new book is called Remembering Emmett Till, and on the anniversary of Till's death, he's here to explain it. David Tell, good morning.
Good morning.
There may be people out there who know Emmett Till's name and have a vague sense of what happened to him, but the details are murky. Can you retell the basics of the story just to get everyone up to speed?
My pleasure. In the summer of 1955, Emmett Till was a 14-year-old African-American boy living in Chicago. In August of that year, he took a vacation to visit his cousins in the Mississippi Delta, and while he was there, he and his cousins visited Bryant's Grocery and Meat Market, a small store in the heart of the Delta. Most historians agree that when Emmett Till left the grocery store, he whistled at the 21-year-old white shopkeeper named Carolyn Bryant, and this, of course, was a serious breach of Jim Crow social norms. 3 days later, Carolyn, that is the shopkeeper's husband, named Roy Bryant, and his half-brother, J.W. Milam, kidnapped Emmett Till. They tortured him so severely that 6 square inches of his skull fell free. They shot him. They attached his body to a 75-pound cotton gin fan, and they dropped him in the Mississippi River. 3 days later, his body was found floating. 1 month after that, two of the murderers, Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam, were acquitted by an all-white jury. And 2 months after the trial, an activist named T.R.M. Howard traveled from the Mississippi Delta to Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, where he told the story of Emmett Till. In the audience that night was a young seamstress who heard the story and 3 days later refused to give up her seat on a Montgomery bus, and the civil rights movement, as we know it, was off and running.
So I have noticed some of the care you have taken in how you phrased some pieces of this. Notably, that last piece, you did not directly assert a cause and effect between the story of Emmett Till and who I assume is Rosa Parks.
Yeah.
And that's part of what you write about in your book.
Right. I mean, the story about the connection between Emmett Till and Rosa Parks is a really controversial one. The story is widely told with a causal influence along the lines, and this story is told by Jesse Jackson and Mississippi politician David Jordan, both of whom say that Rosa Parks told them that she was thinking of Emmett Till when she refused to give up her seat. But that story is so controversial that in 2017, when they were remaking a sign for the Mississippi Freedom Trail, the state of Mississippi actually decided that they weren't quite sure that happened. And so they took that quotation off of a sign and replaced it with a different quotation from Emmett Till's mother. So that's just a little anecdote about how controversial in Mississippi the Rosa Parks connection is.
And in fact, the whole process of remembering Emmett Till is still controversial there. You are one of two scholars behind the Emmett Till Memory Project, and the ideas in your book come, as I understand it, largely from the experience of spending lots of time in the Mississippi Delta for that project. So could you start us off by explaining that project? You're creating a digital Emmett Till memory tour in the Mississippi Delta because the brick and mortar memorials kept getting vandalized.
That's right. The story starts really in March of 2008. At that moment, a group of 18 local citizens in Tallahatchie County got together and formed a nonprofit. And they formed a nonprofit because they were tired of the story of Till's murder being ignored. If you want to count, 49 years and 11 months passed between the murder and the first dollar ever spent on Till commemoration and the Mississippi Delta. And to this group of 18 local citizens, this was intolerable. So they banded together, they fundraised, and in March of 2008, they began putting up a series of roadside markers across the county commemorating a number of the spots significant to the Till story. And I think a lot of our listeners will know what happens next. The signs were vandalized. Some of them were shot, some were spray painted, some were stolen, some were thrown in the river, some were defaced with acid. And over the course of years, the vandalism was targeted and it was persistent. And so the idea of the Emmett Till Memory Project was simple. People can shoot a sign, but they can't shoot a smartphone app. So we decided to put the stories of Till's murder onto the app. We call it the Emmett Till Memory Project. It just went live about 2 weeks ago. So it's free to download at both the App Store and Google Play. And it will take users to 18 sites in the Mississippi Delta, all of which are central to the story of Till's murder.
So then you went to the Mississippi Delta, started talking to people there, visiting sites, deciding what belonged in there. The story behind that is actually super interesting because the process involved, you had to include a certain number for it to appear on certain formats. And so, like, the technology in some ways hemmed you in. But while you were traveling to learn more, to come face-to-face with these sites yourself, what did you understand about the way we remember Emmett Till by being there that you didn't already know?
Well, I think the biggest thing that struck me from being there, so I've been writing about Emmett Till since about 2003. So, I mean, I've been writing about Emmett Till for years. I left for my first trip to Mississippi very convinced that I knew every relevant detail. And when I got down there and started traveling from site to site in order to make the app, I was amazed by the stories I was hearing about how local communities were dealing with the aftermath and the legacy of the murder. And these were stories that I, as an educated scholar, had never heard. And so this was the origin of the book project. Like, how do I take these stories that I'm learning when I visit the Mississippi Delta and pass them on to the next generation?
Remembering Emmett Till is the book you've written, and it has to do with what you call the ecology of memory. Can you explain that terminology?
What I'm trying to get at there is that the story that has been passed down through the generations is not a simple reflection of the facts of 1955. I'd like to think of it as a giant game of telephone. You know that kids game where, like, you line up the kids, you whisper something on one end, and then they pass it down, and by the time it reaches the other end, it's a totally different story?
Yes.
That is what has happened with the story of Emmett Till, that as it's been passed down, the story has changed because of the racial convictions or because of the financial desperation of the particular storytellers. And so the phrase ecology of memory is just a nod to the fact that our memory of the past is deeply entangled with the needs of the present, things like financial desperation or poverty, things like enduring racism. Those factors shape what we think we know about Till's murder as much as the distant facts of 1955.
We'll dig into some of that in a moment. Let's start with some specifics. One of the things I found fascinating was the issue of where the Emmett Till story actually begins and how charged that once was. Bryant's Grocery is a place that gets treated as the site where the story began. And you see some irony in that when it comes to commemorating Emmett Till the man.
So you're right. The first stop on the Mississippi Freedom Trail, that's a commemorative effort that was launched in 2011. And when they launched it in April of that year, the state of Mississippi made Bryant's Grocery the first site on the Mississippi Freedom Trail. And they did so because it was their belief that that's where the story of Emmett Till started and that's where the civil rights movement started.
Yes. And someone else has made that argument.
Yeah, you're right. And so there's a deep irony there, though. Because in 1955, the only people who argued that the murder started at Bryant's Grocery was the legal defense team for the murderers. The prosecution, the good guys in 1955, they argued the Till story started not at Bryant's Grocery, but 3 miles away at the home of Moses Wright. Now, they did that because if the prosecution could convince the jury that the story started at the home of Moses Wright, where the kidnapping happened, that would make Bryant's Grocery irrelevant, and that would mean Carolyn Bryant would not be allowed to testify, because they knew that if Carolyn Bryant testified that a white woman could tell a fabricated story about a sexually aggressive African-American boy, and game over. As soon as that story was told, the prosecution knew they had no chance at a conviction.
So what, can you spell out what is ironic about a commemorative tour treating this site as the starting place? Because I don't think anyone would argue that the site is insignificant to this story.
No, it's a deeply significant site, and it's a site I have a lot of investment in. The irony comes from the fact that in 1955, it was, for lack of nuance, it was the racists who were focused on sort of the centrality of this spot. And by 2011, that history was buried beneath the pomp and circumstance and sort of the celebration of the Mississippi Freedom Trail. So the site in Money, Mississippi essentially switched sides between 1955 and 2011.
I also, one of the other things that I really found intriguing was as you move on through the story to the murder and the trial, you make another distinction that locals may get, but the rest of us would have no way of getting, a distinction between the planters, so people who had plantations, although that term has greater meaning than that, and I hope you'll explain it. And then the people in the hills, which corresponds to a distinction in two types of racism that existed in two different communities. So both racism just expressed very differently, with the dividing line between them being the Tallahatchie River.
So this is absolutely fascinating, Gina, that this particular shape of racism is indexed to the contours of the land. Let me explain. The Mississippi Delta is as flat as a pancake. In fact, a number of authors say it's so flat you can see the curvature of the earth. Now, I've tried, and I have never been able to see that, but it is certainly flat. And the reason it's flat is because historically, every spring, the Mississippi River would flood. And when it flooded, it would both flatten the land and cover it with rich minerals carried from the almost entirety of the United States and deposited in the Mississippi Delta, which makes the Delta some of the absolute richest soil in the world. We're talking 40 feet of topsoil, which means in the Mississippi Delta, right after the Civil War, the only thing standing between white planters and fortune was African-American labor. And that made a huge difference in how
African Americans... Or the possibility of losing it.
Right, exactly. They were scared constantly that they were going to lose their African-American labor. And so the Delta sort of developed its own form of racism. They were deeply committed to white supremacy, but they also fancied themselves... sort of characterized themselves by a sort of interpersonal kindness with their own particular laborers. It was a kindness not driven by virtue. It was a kindness driven by an anxiety that if they weren't kind, then these African Americans would leave and they would not have the labor needed to make a fortune. Now, just across the Tallahatchie River in the hills, the soil wasn't as rich. The land was not tillable because it was hilly. And thus, there was no incentive to treat African Americans with kindness. And therefore, just historically speaking, the Klan always flourished in the hills far more than in the Delta. Now, both are forms of racism. It just takes different forms in different places.
And so how does this influence the way we think we know the Emmett Till story, if in fact we think we know it at all?
Okay, so this is crazy. But 11 of the 12 jurors lived on the far eastern side of Tallahatchie County, which means that 11 of the 12 came from the hills. And so they developed then this tradition in 1955, but it's a tradition that I have heard people tell me even still in the 21st century, that the only reason the killers were acquitted is because the jurors were from the hills. And I hope you see the logic here. In the hill country, there was no incentive to treat black people kindly. Therefore, racism was more
vitriolic. It was expressed more overtly.
Yes, more overtly. That's well said. And because of that, then these jurors obviously or supposedly had no qualms about acquitting the white murderers. It's a logic that is near and dear to the Delta planters, because what it allows them to do is shift responsibility for the murder over the river, into the hills, and off of themselves.
So the other thing about this. You know, you've written about some Emmett Till jokes that older residents of the Delta and the Hills remember people telling while this was going on. I will not ask you to repeat those jokes on the air because they are horrible, but
Thank you. Can you
talk about what they revealed to you?
They reveal a culture in which African American life was simply not valued beyond its value as a punchline in a joke, that you could take a corpse floating in the water and turn it into a, and that the experience of a corpse floating in the water could be a common enough and shared enough experience that it could be sort of the mutually understood punchline of a joke, I think tells us a lot about the extent to which Black life was devalued in the Mississippi Delta.
So I think, you know, the reverberations of this story, I mean, as you speak just now, become even more apparent than I think they already would be. Just the reverberations when you hear stories about people like Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown. Is that something that, when you think about the way we remember Emmett Till, is that also part of how someone living in Missouri today might hear the story?
I like to think of Emmett Till as the proto-history of the Black Lives Matter movement. And in a lot of ways, that's just not my opinion. That's almost empirical because you could just do a Google search of Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown or Ferguson or Black Lives Matter. And with every new police killing, Emmett Till's name surges back into the news as a sort of historical precedent that explains our contemporary moment. And this is why I think it's so important that we remember Emmett Till, because the stories we tell about our past shape how we make sense of our world today. And our world today is still characterized by the killing of African American boys. And unless we know our history, we might mistakenly write off those killings as the product of a few bad apples. But if you know our history, you know this is a persistent problem. And so as strange as it sounds, Emmett Till is at the forefront of the American imagination more today than he ever was in the 20th century.
One of the other things that you've mentioned that we haven't really talked about is the way that the places that have what you might call a memorial infrastructure are often places that have an apparatus to get funding, but that the way you make a case for funding can also distort the memory you're trying to preserve. Can you talk about that a little?
So the condition of remembering Emmett Till is tourism, because tourism is the mechanism by which commemoration has the potential at least to become profitable. And so the best example here is the Emmett Till Memorial Commission, the nonprofit that I work very closely with in Tallahatchie County. They were formed in 2006, is a collaboration of 9 white citizens and 9 Black citizens. And I'm generalizing here, and there's exceptions, but by and large, the 9 white citizens cared about stimulating the Sumner economy and saving their own courthouse. While the African-American citizens on the commission cared about racial justice and remembering Emmett Till. But building a commemorative infrastructure became a sort of middle ground around which all 18 citizens could rally. And because building a commemorative infrastructure served both the needs of tourism and memory, it became the Emmett Till Memory Commission has done more for Till's murder than anyone else in the whole world, simply because commerce and commemoration go hand in hand.
How do you think we should be commemorating Emmett Till today on the anniversary of his death?
I think one of my dearest convictions is that Till's story is not over in September of 1955. It's a 64-year-old story now, and it's not done yet. So as we think about the murder, I think it's my hope that we don't think about it as a thing of the past, but we think about it as a story 64 years in the making that still informs how we think about police killings from Trayvon to Ferguson and beyond.
David Tell, thank you so much for joining us from KU.
You're welcome.
David Tell is a KU professor of communications. He's also the principal investigator of the Emmett Till Memory Project and the author of a new book, Remembering Emmett Till. He'll be giving a talk on that book at the Lawrence Public Library September 9th. Up next, a joke about boys who dance has sparked a larger conversation. We'll be joined by male dancers in Kansas City to talk about it in just a minute. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And as you've probably heard, the men of ballet have been in the media spotlight ever since Good Morning America's Laura Spencer, not to be confused with KCUR's Laura Spencer, made a careless and insensitive joke about Prince George of England apparently loving to dance at age 6. A few days later, with male dancers in New York protesting on the street outside her office, she apologized, and the protests outside turned into a joy-filled ballet lesson led by men on the street. People are talking about it, including the men of the Kansas City Ballet, who posed for a proudly defiant photograph, which they shared on social media to express solidarity with Prince George and all the other boys out there who want to dance, to show them that it's possible to do what they want to do and live the lives they want to live. Devin Carney is the artistic director of the Kansas City Ballet, and Devin, talk to me about that photograph.
Well, thank you for having me on the program. I really appreciate you taking the time. The photograph, it was a clear and immediate response once we had heard about it. And I pulled all the men together and said, we need to say something. And so we took that picture and I wrote a thought-felt post, which went kind of viral. And I really am proud of our dancers, of the company, and of the school, all the boys in the school as well. But it was really just a statement of solidarity for what was going on in New York.
Beyond the comment itself on the air, when you say solidarity, solidarity mm-hmm. in what kind of condition? And solidarity is usually like you're in a fight together.
Well, that's a good way to describe it, Gina. We are in an art form that is fairly underrepresented, you know, in the general consensus of the cultural mind of the country. And it's very important to stand together when one young boy is shamed in such a way at the very, very beginning of their possible career and their desire to be a dancer. And that's the solidarity, that it's okay to do that. And it's something that they should have the opportunity to do without feeling in some way that it's less than good or right.
We're also joined by Tyrone Aiken of Kansas City Friends of Alvin Ailey. Hi, Tyrone.
Good morning, Gina.
What was your just immediate reaction when you heard about the joke itself and the fallout from it?
My immediate reaction was one of surprise. I initially thought, well, this is being blown out of proportion. And then I had to step back and think that what is really insensitive about it is the challenges that it creates for young people, all young people, boys, girls, that want to dance. As Devin said, it is an art form that is not in the schools. So because it's not, in order to access it, you have to really be brave enough to want to try it, especially as a young boy.
To take the step yourself.
Yes. And so
to tell your parents.
To even face your peers. So there's still really challenges dealing with parents and young people that you interface with regularly. And so for me, it was the idea that there is an opportunity to really bring forth why it's important that boys are dancing, why it's important that men dance, why it's important that dance as an art form has something to tell us about our society and how we interact with each other.
Where do the two of you think that the shaming of men who dance comes from? And I'm curious whether you think it's gotten better since you were young.
I would say that it comes from an antiquated, stereotypical thought process that somehow men who dance are weak sissies, that it's not really a profession. You know, if you've been in the profession long enough, you are asked when you're found out that you're a dancer, they say, oh, well, what do you do for a living? So it's not even thought of as a real profession. And that's a very old, antiquated thought process. And I believe that's exactly where it comes from. I think, Tyrone, you might have a little bit more to say about that.
So For me, it is a little bit deeper than that. It really is about the idea of what men do versus what women do. So I see readily where young girls are put into dance as just a matter-of-fact way of their development. It is something that men are stared away from, or boys are stared away from at a young age. And there is a stereotype that goes with that that's sort of reinforced. And it reinforces this idea that whether it's dealing with, as Devin said, being effeminate or being gay, or all of those things play a role in how we then interpret who dance is for or who should be doing dance.
You know, it seems, as I think about this, that some of the things that are considered like not for boys are things that have to do with expression, whether it's an interest or a passion like dance, or just a normal human thing like crying. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. So there is this emotional connection to it. But what people don't understand is dance is very physical. It's very athletic. And it really is about the idea of using but not only the body, but also the mind in terms of that emotional connection. So I think when you look at it purely from an athletic standpoint, it's a great opportunity for young people to engage in expressing who they are.
You know, for a while now, people have been really embracing the idea that we need to empower girls to feel that they can do all of the things once reserved for boys. And that is still not a perfect, but people at least seem to get that it matters. And for some reason, we seem to be slower to embrace the idea that boys should feel empowered to do the things once reserved for girls.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think that there are many different professions out there that are, like Tyrone was saying as well, is that, you know, boys are steered away from, and girls are encouraged to do, right? A great example is, you know, Swan Lake, for instance. You see it in popular television over the decades, you know, mocking ballet dancers, especially if a guy gets in a row with a bunch of women. And that's not
like a comedic
scene right.
in a movie.
Exactly. So we're always the punchline. And that's not what the art form is all about. And, you know, as Tyrone said, it's about expressing the human condition in all its glorious forms. And there's sensitivity in that art form. And so...
And there's thought and physicality in
yes,
the art form.
Yes, there's power. There's athleticism. There's incredible prowess necessary to do what a male dancer does. And I really believe that it's a celebrated art form in many other countries.
And I do think that all of the discussion that we're having now about gender nonconforming, non-binary, all of those things are helping us address the issue around what task or what job or what should you look like or what clothing you should or shouldn't wear. All of those things are being challenged now. And I think that discussion is important, in particular for young people.
Call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation. You can also tweet us at KCURCST. We're talking about men and boys in dance, but also gender expectations for boys and men, period. 816-235-2888. I want to bring a dance student into the conversation. His name is Drake Taylor. He's 16 years old. He lives in Kansas City, and he's one of seven boys in dance from across the country who will be featured in a documentary that's still in the works about this exact topic. Drake, good morning.
Good morning.
Tell me the story of how you got into dance.
I got into dance. My parents saw me dancing around the house, and they thought, you know, why not give it a try? So they put me in dance classes.
How old were you?
I was 3. Yeah, and I loved it, and I've been in dance ever since, and I love it still as much today.
Are you able to articulate what you love about it? I know that's just a tall order for anyone who likes anything, but can you attempt it?
You know, when you love something, you really just know that you love it. But I love how physical it is. I love getting a good workout from it. But I also love being able to connect with audiences. And I love being able to make people feel emotions through my movement.
You know, I used to dance when I was your age. And something that I remember about it is that there was this process of using your like mental focus to do something that at first just seems like a body can't do that. A body can't turn and then stop on a dime. with no outside force acting on it. But then when you try it again and try it again and try it again and think harder and work harder, eventually it happens one day. And there's just this exhilaration. Is that something that you experience?
Yeah, I think that's also plays into the idea that people really don't know what happens behind the scenes of dance because we make it look so easy on stage. If we didn't make it look easy, we wouldn't be doing our jobs. And dance takes a lot of practice to get hard things, like you said.
How do you think that gender has shaped your experience in ballet, in the studio, in the classroom?
I think as a society, we have kind of a stigma about male dancers. So that means there are going to be less dancers because people don't necessarily think it's like normal to be a male dancer, which it completely is. So I think the more we educate ourselves about male dancers, the more male dancers there will be.
So they're just, your experience is partly just being, are there, how many other male dancers are in your dance class?
There is about one other.
Yeah. I mean, my memory of dance was that all through my training, there was one boy who moved through those classes with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how it is.
What is that like for you?
You know, it's different because in any other sport, there's usually a more equal number. The number of boys to girls in dance is extremely, like, crazy. But it's sometimes can be hard not knowing that you're being represented in your profession. So I think the more male dancers we can get and the more we can get rid of the stigma, the better the dance world will be, which has been a great outcome of this whole controversy, because I think it's really created a platform for male dancers to speak up and tell their stories and educate people.
How has it been to be a boy who does ballet outside the dance studio?
What do you mean by that?
At school, at family functions, just wherever you go, that this is what, if you're doing ballet at 16, you are a very serious ballet student because what it takes mm-hmm. to be doing that at that level. So that just has to, I assume, be part of your identity.
Yeah. Being a male dancer is very much a lifestyle because when people ask you, you know, what do? You can sometimes some people will kind of be judging and because they don't understand what it really is. And like how you said earlier, how people sometimes don't even think of it as a profession. Yeah.
Yeah. That it would be just a hobby.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That you've mentioned the stigma a few times, and in what way do you feel the stigma, and like what kinds of situations do you perceive it in?
I think a lot of times male dancers will be picked on or bullied, like in this controversy. And it, even though people may not pick on me or other male dancers, it's still there. So I think the more we can educate ourselves about males in dance, the more the stigma will go away.
Devin, you were just agreeing very enthusiastically. Can you explain what you were feeling just now listening to a younger man having experiences that you can relate to in this way?
Yeah. Thank you, Drake, for being open about that. I really appreciate that. And it does remind me of my high school years. And, you know, it's tough being a male dancer, especially a male ballet dancer for some reason, because I hid it during my high school years.
You didn't tell people?
I lied through my teeth, like a lot.
That's amazing, though, because, I mean, like I was saying, by the time you're doing ballet in high school, correct me if I'm wrong, if this wasn't your experience, but that's hours and hours and mm-hmm. hours every week, because mm-hmm. you can't just show up and do ballet once a week. Your body would not do it.
Right. And so I was helping my mom grocery shop. I was going to the dentist. And I can fill in the blank of the list of things I did after school. And, you know, it was tough, Drake, because there was one day where, you know, of course, I'm in the Nutcracker. You can't get away from that. People are going to come and see that, right? And some family came, and one of them was a classmate of mine and saw me in the show. And guess what? It came out in school, and it was a tough moment because everybody started bullying me and picking on me like crazy. But I will tell you this quick story, Drake, which was really quite exciting. And it really put an end to it. And I really, there was a good to the end of this. And that was a big football player was picking on me in the hallway, you know. And he says, "You can't, you're such a sissy," all this kind of stuff, right? I said, "Okay, well, wait. Step back. Can you do this?" And I jumped up, I went up in the air, turned around twice. We call that a double tour and layer. And he said, "Oh, I could do that. No problem." And he went around halfway, fell flat on his face into a locker. And from that point on, it was like the education had occurred mm-hmm. that, oh, it's a lot harder than I thought it was. So, you know, that's what I was thinking of was to be there supportive for you, Drake, as you pursue this art form. Follow your dreams, okay?
Call 816-235-2888 to join this discussion about men and boys in ballet, but also men and boys in our world, what is expected and what's sort of off limits in an unspoken way. 816-235-2888 Central Standard. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're responding to the controversy surrounding a Good Morning America conversation where a young boy who happens to be royalty was mocked for liking to dance by a grown-up who was anchoring that show. There's been a furious response and then a very celebratory outcome when that anchor apologized publicly. I'm talking today with Tyrone Aiken of KC Friends of Alvin Ailey, Devin Carney of the Kansas City Ballet, and 16-year-old ballet student Drake Taylor. Welcome back, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So our switchboards have lit up with people who want to join this discussion. I'd like to turn first to Ian in Overland Park. Hi, Ian.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. How about you?
Oh, well, thank you.
What would you like to share?
So I've been a professional dancer for probably about 20 years, and I have a six-year-old son, and of course I've, you know, been teaching him pretty much since he was born how to turn and spot and things like that. And he was playing at school, came home when I picked him up the other day, and told him one of the other kids said he'd make a wonderful pole dancer because he was spinning around at the playground.
Just a kid spinning around.
Yeah, I was a little shocked that somebody would say that to him, and I just, you know, it made me worry because I've loved dancing my entire life, and I really want him to get into it, and then I also don't want to sort of, I guess, inflict that opportunity for him to be, you know, mercilessly teased, even at the age of six.
You know, Tyrone Aiken, your mouth is agape listening to this story.
Well, I understand what he's saying. I've worked with lots of young people, and they are always, in particular boys, dealing with the issue of masculinity and what it means to dance and be expressive and to be free and how peers can really infringe on that. And what we really need to be thinking about is not only how to support young people and being their own selves, but also teaching the adults that are in those spaces how to intervene and to support that expression as well. Because I think that really matters. And when those adults can step in and actually make that a lesson for everyone to learn from, it makes it a little bit easier for that person to feel that they can be successful at doing what they want to do.
Along those lines, Megan is calling us with a parenting question. Megan's calling from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Megan.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on the show. My question kind of echoes Ian's, but maybe on the other side. I am a mom of two young boys, a 3-year-old and a 16-month-old, so they're pretty young still. I grew up as a tomboy and with sisters. We were very into sports, kind of, you know, Gina, you mentioned how we've encouraged that more among females, it seems like, and I love that because that was very much my identity growing up. And so I feel like there's this pressure and expectation as a mom who was a tomboy, and then especially with two boys, to encourage that. My three-year-old has, I mean, he just loves to dance, and it's so fun because we can be goofy and silly and, you know, just explore some of that together. It's so fun, but I do wonder as he grows in the next few years here, I would love to enroll him in a dance class, but I'm a little clueless with how to go about doing that, or even as a mother, my husband's very supportive too, but like as parents, what are some language things that we should either gravitate towards or steer away from? How do we go about finding a good class that will be inclusive, and some of those kinds of things? If any of the panelists can provide any insight, that would be very helpful.
Yeah, so the bigger question being, how does a parent support a young boy who clearly wants to go this direction?
I would say, you know, at three, he's just starting to find himself. That's pretty young, although Drake started at three, actually. Let's remember that. You know, you've discovered that he likes to dance, and I think that's fantastic. And so it's a matter of putting him in an environment that gives him the opportunity to first look at that as an idea, as a more sort of organized event, and have him go watch a class. It doesn't have to be necessarily a ballet class or a modern class, but just any sort of movement class where he can get a chance to sort of see if he's attracted to it. Obviously, you know, just because you start dancing doesn't mean you have to stay with that exact same discipline, but he can look around, I guess I could say. You know, he needs to experiment with what might speak to him. And that's the most important thing I can say here, is that you want to find something that will speak to him, that will give him the freedom to be able to express himself.
Yeah.
I'd like to tell parents that at 3, 4, 5, 6, it should be fun. They should find a place that they like. They should find a place that's open that will allow them to observe. They should find a place where that child feels happy. And this should be something that is joyous, that is play-oriented, and allowing them to explore movement. As they get older, if they continue, it will get more sort of codified and more serious and structured. But at that age, it should really be about the fun and enjoyment of just doing an activity.
I mean, Drake, I think you are clearly in actually the best position to advise here.
Yeah, I think starting at any job, profession, sport, et cetera, at a young age is always a good idea, because you can kind of feel around and see, you know, what your child wants. I think with me, it was very obvious. I was always happy coming home from dance. So I think just go for it, try it. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But just start looking for studios and try dance.
Well, I want to bring in another voice here. We'll get back to our callers, but Matthew Powell is with us. He's artistic director of Ballet Nova in Washington. He danced in the Kansas City Ballet from 2001 to 2008. And Matthew, what are you hearing in this conversation from afar?
For me, I'm hearing that we need more accessibility in the community. We need to work on outreach, because Drake, you're talking a lot about education, and I think that's fantastic. But I think I grew up in a small town in West Virginia, and we didn't have the opportunity to see male ballet dancers. I was pretty much the only boy in my class. And so I think if we can really work to kind of spread our message far and wide out there, we're going to be able to bring more people in, because you can see things on, you know, Good Morning America, you can see things on YouTube, but there's nothing like experience it firsthand for yourself. And so I really think that kind of getting out there and working on education outreach is pretty critical for this.
Are you heartened by the conversation that has emerged from this kind of controversy, or do you think that ultimately just the fact that it happened at all is demoralizing?
I am completely inspired by the dance community and what they've done to come together, and I'm completely happy at the outcome. I like the way in which it was presented. It was presented with love and passion, which is what I feel dance is all about. And so, like I said, I think it was a really good moment for the dance community on the whole.
Well, thank you so much, Matthew. I am sorry to not have longer to spend with you, but thank you for joining this conversation. Matthew is Artistic Director of Ballet Nova Conservatory of Dance in Washington, D.C. I'm going to go now to another one of our callers, Jacob in Lenexa. Jacob, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. How about you?
Good, good, good. So I actually graduated from a music theater conservatory in New York City, and I remember, like, just hearing what was said on Good Morning America, kind of, I was really taken aback because it wasn't something I expected to hear like today. As a younger dancer and performer, I see, like, my dance classes in my school had about the same amount of guys as they had girls, and to me it didn't really strike me anymore as like a conversation we were having. You know, I was just really, really surprised. Maybe it's just something that the younger generations have accepted, but I was really surprised to hear that we're still gendering things like this. Like, I guess to me it was just one of those
things. I mean, we gender Legos. Like, there are, like, pink ones for girls.
Seriously. And I just think it was kind of, I mean, I know a lot of people thought it was dumb, but I guess I didn't understand why we were still having this conversation after, you know, after we had the whole women's rights movement, and now we're, like, in the middle of completely redefining what gender is, and people are becoming more open and acceptable to different terms. I just think that it was really surprising.
Jacob, you know, I hate to tell you really something. Everyone in this studio is shaking their head right now.
Yeah, for me, a big part of why we're having this conversation and why there's a long way to go is that dance is one of those art forms that's not readily accessible. It's not in the schools. It's not like music. It's not like art. So there's not the opportunity for all of the teachers, all of the parents, all of the students, boys and girls, to experience this art form and see what it's really about. And so, as Matthew talked about, accessibility is key to changing some of these ideas that we need to really be talking about.
I think it's going to start in school. I think the more that we can get, I mean, school is a place where all kids are at. So I think if the education can start there, then they'll become interested and more boys will become interested in dancing and go to studios, and just there'll be more avenues for people to get interested in dance.
You know, so many of our questions, Drake, have been about what adults can do to support boys who may be experiencing mocking, teasing, even outright bullying. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there has ever been an adult who you see as like a model for the grown-ups out there who want to support boys in pursuing whatever interests they have, even if they're outside the sort of like box. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I think any parents of a male dancer could be that model because they support their kids even though some people really still don't get it.
By driving them to the lessons or whatever.
Yes, that's so important.
That?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that, Devin?
I agree. I think that it starts with your parents, of course. I think that there are some great role models in our industry that are great to look to when a boy is feeling the pressure outside the studios. There are some great role models out there. You can find many of them online, of course. And, you know, there's also that fact that it's a road that's not easy. And I think that's something that as a parent you have to help your child understand is that, you know, you're choosing something that's unique. It's beautiful. It's different, you know, but, you know, eventually there's going to come that point where someone's going to say, that's not really an acceptable thing for me, they might say. So to really be prepared for that, I think that's also something to educate someone in as well.
For me, it really was my German teacher. German club is where I started dancing. German folk dancing. But when I discovered ballet, many of my teachers said, no, don't do it. It's a dead end. And this one role model said, you can do anything you want. If that's what your passion is, go for it. And she is still in my life today. And that's over 40 years ago.
There's a lot of controversy around telling kids they can do whatever they want, be whatever they want.
That's true. But that is something that I think is so vital to finding what we kind of search for in terms of either happiness, contentment. You talk about work or talk about career or talk about what's going to fuel you. And so I think it's really important to have that idea of finding something that you can be passionate about and wake up excited to do every day.
And to learn to own it no matter what anyone else says.
And I would say one last thing, and that is remember words matter to a child. And everything you say to a child who's interested in pursuing this beautiful art form, make sure it's positive and encouraging, because just like his German teacher made a huge difference in him, that, you know, saying something negative to a child at that moment could make a complete life change for them. So be careful with what you say and always encourage children to do what they love to do.
We've got to go now, but I really appreciate all of you for joining this discussion. Tyrone Aiken of the Kansas City Friends of Albanese, thank you.
Thank you.
Devin Carney of the Kansas City Ballet, thank you.
Thank you, Gina.
And 16-year-old ballet student Drake Taylor, to be featured in a documentary called Why Dance, thank you and good luck.
Thank you so much.
You can grab both of this morning's discussions at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Keep talking on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf and Aviva Okeson Haberman. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.